Yeah, that's it. I'm shutting the door here.
So, hi folks, let's get started. So, I'd like to introduce Raju Rangaswamy. He is a faculty member at Florida International University, where he has a systems research group, and they do research on a lot of things of great interest to us, including persistent memory, overall systems issues, virtualization, and the like. And so he's here today. He's going to start talking about persistent memory, and then hopefully we will also be able to cover some additional topics. And he has won numerous awards, including an NSF Career Award. So welcome, Raju. We're very happy to
have
you.
Thanks a lot for inviting me and having me. It's my pleasure to be here. We have lots of exciting things going on at Fusion, and I hear my timing is right because you're now able to talk about more things
with
respect to your new products. So I'm eager to hear about that. So today's talk is actually a multi-part talk, and I'll try to get through as many of these parts as I can in the time we have. The first part is perhaps the most interesting to you folks. It's a system that we built. It's basically a library at this point, called Software Persistent Memory, and the idea behind this library is to have applications use conventional volatile memory interfaces, but allocate persistent memory instead. So part one is this library we built, which we call Software Persistent Memory, and part two is some of the recent work. So let me get started off by motivating Software Persistent Memory a little bit, and actually abbreviate this library as SoftPM going forward, easier on the tongue. So the first part of the motivation comes from the observation that there is a lot of persistence you need for metadata in system software, right?
Can everyone on the phone please mute?
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Right. So can you hear me okay on the phone?
Much better now.
Okay, thank you very much. So, you know, in system software, there's a lot of persistence for data that's necessary. For instance, file systems do layout management, and they maintain a lot of metadata structures. Journaling, versioning, snapshotting, continuous data protection, they all have some metadata that they need to keep persistent. And in the software or firmware that Fusion IO writes, for instance, I'm sure there are a lot of persistent data structures that you use. So that's one part of the motivation. The second part of the motivation is even high-level application data persistence, client-facing end-user applications, databases, key-value stores. All of these maintain some form of persistent data. I'm not sure why. Okay. And then some part of our motivation also comes from high-performance applications, where they need computational state itself to be persistent for restartability, right? So these are our three motivating applications or scenarios. I'll start with an example of a simple balanced binary tree, right? So before balancing, after an insert, you have some, for some reason, the colors are not showing up on the screen, but the 15 and 17 should be in red. So I'm not sure what's up with the colors.
They're showing up on as red in the WebEx itself.
In the WebEx? Okay.
Because the connector might be a bit...
The connector may be a bit loose, the one there.
Yeah. This one?
Yeah.
But it's okay.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, but don't worry. The WebEx is where the majority of the people are watching.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Sure. Okay,
I can...
Yeah.
All right. So thing is, after balancing, you have a different sort of a tree. And so what this means is that the state of memory becomes substantially different than what it was in the beginning, after the insert and balancing operations, right? And imagine if this tree needs to be persistent. How do you go about doing it? It's not a straightforward task. There are a whole bunch of different complications that need to be addressed. First, you need to know all the data to persist. You could take a very simplistic approach and say that I'm going to persist the entire binary tree starting from the root every time there is a change, but that's not the most efficient way. Now you could keep track of all the changes to the data, and that's also hard, right? Because you need to know what changed. In this example where the tree got balanced, a lot of things got changed, right? And how do you know which pointers got changed and how the structure of the data itself got changed? Even if you go ahead with the approach, you have to build in routines that would serialize your data structures, right? And that's not always easy. A binary tree is a little complex, but you can think of really arbitrarily complex data structures, and they may not be just one data structure. They may be a mesh of multiple data structures, and those are the kinds of scenarios that we would like to simplify with the system that we are building. Right? A little bit on related work very quickly. There is work on process-level checkpointing. These sorts of approaches are transparent to the developer, but then these are not usable within system software, so if you're working inside the operating system, it's not easy to checkpoint the entire OS, except writing the entire virtual memory out to storage, and that's really heavyweight. And more importantly, it's not easy to separate persistent and volatile data because systems use both persistent data and volatile data at the same time. Right? There was a whole bunch of work on object-oriented databases in the early 90s, and they do allow separating persistent and volatile data, but they also require substantial changes to the code itself. Right? And you need to define your objects that are persistent, figure out when objects start getting modified and keep track of all of that. And finally, these solutions can of course be heavyweight because they are driven by an underlying object-oriented database. There are recent work on persistent memory, and they allow separating persistent and volatile data, but they also require substantial code changes. And some of the names I've listed here. There was an early system called RVM, which was built in 1993 from CMU, and some of the more recent solutions also turn out to be device-specific. They assume byte-level interfaces, which may not be widely available, at least not yet. So our goals with SoftVM are that developers should be restricted to just specifying top-level data structures to persist, and when to make checkpoints, rather when to persist these data structures. And then finally, how to recover execution state once the data structures are restored into memory. Right? So we want to significantly raise the level of abstraction to working with persistent memory. So have as much as possible conventional volatile memory interfaces, and then have the underlying library do all the heavy lifting in terms of figuring out what to persist, what are the changes that are in the system, or what data structures got modified, and how to optimally write these out to storage. Right. That was our goal starting in the beginning. Right. And we came up with a solution that requires minimum developer effort to get data persistence. I think we managed to accomplish most of our initial goals in terms of the level of abstraction, and that's where the first bullet comes from. The solution automatically detects data to be checkpointed, tracks changes to data, and writes only the modifications out, and therefore it minimizes checkpoint creation and recovery time. So there is a lot of I/O level optimizations that we do in our library, assuming that the library has full control of the device. Right? So if you have application level control over the device, you can do a lot of interesting optimizations there. Now, although in this talk I'll present results with the library, but moving forward, what we would like to do is to pull this library into the OS so that the interface, so you can think of a parallel interface to the file system interface. Right, a persistent memory interface vertically occupying the operating system that would manage our device. And you could think that in the future, maybe 10 or 20 years from now, maybe that's the only interface we'll have, right? So for at least some of the systems that we are thinking about. So I'd like to point out one core construct in our system, which we call the container. And the container is a self-describing unit of persistent memory. So applications create containers. They can create more than one container. And they map persistent data structures to this container. And when I say map, it's actually not an explicit mapping, but more of an implicit mapping. So what the application would do is to associate some root structure with the container, and then the library would automatically discover all the data that's reachable from this root structure and put it in the container. This container is restorable with a single operation, so what you get when you restore is the root of the container, and the application knows how to navigate everything starting from the root. It can access all the data that was made persistent.
So a container would be something that is mapped into the user space for that particular app? Is that what the notion is?
Yes, yes, you can think
of it. And the containers are persistent by nature?
Containers are persistent by nature.
Okay.
Applications can have more than one container. Each container is independently checkpointable, right?
Okay.
And are these containers shareable across apps?
Right now, no.
Okay.
Right, because and the primary reason for that is, well, they can share across apps as long as they do not overlap in time.
Okay.
So let's say one app created a container, checkpointed it, and then stops using the container. Another app could load to restore the container. If it knows the semantics of the container, it can read and write to it. So this is what we call a
container's process shareable. So the app is multi-process by nature.
Multi-threaded.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Right. So there are some restrictions as to what you can do with multi-threaded apps, and
okay.
I'll talk about those a little bit
okay.
towards the end of the presentation.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So there's this other. Type of container that we are building, which is called a version container, where every checkpoint creates a new version. Then applications can go ahead and restore some past version of the container, right, and switch across container versions with a simple operation. So I have a container version in memory loaded right now as a set of data structures. And so do a simple switch operation from the application standpoint. It's a very simple operation, but in the background, we switch the contents of the container in memory. Automatically. So, and the container versions that we are building are also branchable. So you can load a previous version of a container and you can start exploring alternate branches starting from that point. And so those are some of the additional capabilities we are currently building. So at the core of this system is the ability to discover container data automatically. And I'll tell you very quickly, you know, what are the core ideas there. So we divide memory into two regions. When the application starts off, everything is in volatile memory, right? And in the discovery phase, you can visualize our library moving things from volatile space into persistent space. And that's the space of memory that is written out to storage, right? And that's done in an atomic fashion. So how we do that is by keeping track of all pointers that move across different allocations. Right? So we view memory as a set of memory allocations that are interconnected by pointers. Right? And starting from the root, to be able to explore all the data structures that are reachable, we need to explore all these pointers out and compute a closure. Of this memory, starting from the root, right? So there are four types of pointers, right? There are pointers that go from volatile space to volatile space, then from volatile to persistent, persistent back to volatile, and from persistent to persistent, right? So these are the four possible pointers we could have, right? Of these, the ones that are more interesting and critical in our system are the pointers that span across these two types of spaces, because those are the pointers we need to be really careful about, right? So for instance, if we left some dangling pointers that span these boundaries, when we restore the container, we might have corruption of memory, right? So our goal is to try and address these sorts of pointers. And the way we do it is, So let me walk you through the process of discovering data starting from the root. So the root starts off by being persistent, right? So we have pointers going out of the root. Now you can think of this root as, let's say, the root of the tree, right? And then there are, you know, more than one pointers going out of the root of the tree, right? But the rest of the tree is in volatile space. So we need to figure out which part of memory in the volatile space should be brought into the persistent space. So we traverse pointers, copy memory into persistent space, and keep doing that. And after we copy memory, we free the original piece of memory. So we are memory neutral. It's not that we are using up additional memory than what the application was using earlier. We go ahead and do that. At some point, there are no more pointers to follow, so we stop. But then there is a problem with this picture, right? We have one dangling pointer going out of V4, right? So we need to fix back references. So we go ahead and do that, right? And now the system is in a consistent state again. It is perfectly okay to have pointers going from volatile to persistent, right? Because when we restore the container, the only data that will be in memory is all the data in the persistent space, right? If the application wants to restore some other part of the volatile memory, it would probably either include it as part of the container by creating a pointer from the root, or it would create a separate container that encompasses some of that volatile data, which would then be explored independently and made persistent as well, right?
So this implies that the restoration of a persistent container occurs at the same virtual memory address as it was prior to the...
Right. It does not.
We actually.
I'll walk you through an example as to how we deal with that. So as a recap, sorry about the typo there. The developer only needs to allocate containers, assign root structures to containers, make root structures point to data, and invoke a persistence point creation time. And that's all the application needs to do, right? It doesn't need to worry about what data changed in memory, how to serialize the data structures, how to keep track of changes, nothing, right? So the library takes care of all of that behind the scenes. So yeah, if there is any question at this point, you know, please do ask.
Yeah, this is one of a quick question. How does the library disambiguate bit fields that look like they might be valid addresses, but really are just bit fields?
So in
the data vectors?
So one of the things that I'll talk about in a few slides is that we follow only initialized pointers. So if there is a piece of memory that got allocated and that stores a pointer but didn't get initialized, we don't follow the pointer. So invalid pointer values are avoided by design in our system. Does that answer your question?
Only partially. If I have a data field that just happens to be the same value as a valid pointer, how does that handled in your system?
Okay. So currently our system does not automatically handle, say, an integer that is used as an address, right, as a pointer. We don't handle that. But it's possible through programmer annotation that we can handle it, right? So if a programmer says that I'm going to use this integer as a pointer and tells a library that this is really not an integer but a pointer, then we can include it as part of our list of pointers that we'll walk and traverse and compute closure on when the time for discovery comes. So you can, in other words, in C terminology, annotatively recast integers or any other type as pointers, and our system can deal with that.
Okay, and vice versa too, there's something that I think might look like a pointer. I can say this isn't really a pointer, don't traverse this.
Yes, so I'll talk about the API just briefly. There is, as part of our API, we have an exclude API, says, okay, this pointer should not be followed, because either I'm not interested in whatever this points to, or it's not really a pointer, it's just something that I use for bookkeeping, right? So we have an API that supports that. So let me walk you through an example, and that will also address Nisha's question earlier about what addresses and whether they need to be in the same place upon restore. So let's say you're building a simple linked list. So everyone has written code that looks like this, right? So you go about allocating some memory and initializing some pointers that connect the list. Now, if you want to make this list persistent using our library, what are the things that you need to do? First of all, up there is the root structure, right? So actually, let me use the pointer. So everyone else, can they see my pointer on WebEx?
Yes,
you can. Okay, so there up there is the root structure, right? And the root structure contains only the pointer to the head of the list, right? And then the next thing to do is for the application to allocate a container, right? And followed by marking that list or initializing the list variable contained in the root to the linked list that the application creates, right? And basically that's it. Everything else remains the same as before, right? The application uses its memory as it would use volatile memory, and at some point it decides that the container needs to be made persistent. It goes ahead and invokes a bpoint operation on the container, right? So there's a lot of things going on in the background that I didn't really talk about. So for instance, here's the list, right? Sorry. Here's the list that's connected, right? And this list could span multiple pages of memory, right? At the same time, the library is keeping track of the location of all the pointers that are part of this persistent memory closure set, right? Besides writing the pages that contain the linked list, it also writes a page's memory that contains the pointers, right? I mean, I'm simplifying this a lot because, you know, pointer list can be arbitrarily large, so we deal with all that, but conceptually this is what is going on. Upon restore, all the application needs to do is to call a restore operation, and it immediately has the entire container. Now, in this case, it has a linked list, but you could think of putting all your data structures as part of that container, and these data structures could be arbitrarily complex, and it would all work in the same way, right? So on a restore operation, a lot of things happen behind the scenes, right? First of all, the pages get loaded, right? And then the next thing is that the pointers get fixed. So that answers Nisha's earlier query, which is that we don't need the pages to be in the same portion of the address space. They could be anywhere. And that's what makes our containers even more portable, because now if you move to a different application, it doesn't matter whether the application reserves space for a container. And in the future, we think that everything is a container. Let's say all persistent data is a container. You really may not be able to reserve or pre-allocate portions of your address space for specific containers or specific sizes. It's just not very, very scalable, right? Or even portable, right?
Yeah.
So we deal with that very thorny issue in our design itself.
Okay.
Right. So there are some details that I'm skipping here. But one of the aspects of our system that is really powerful is the static translator that we build, right? And the static translator is illustrated using this simple example. Whenever there is a call to allocate memory, the static translator inserts a hint to the runtime of the library to say that there is a certain allocation of a certain size, right? And for all initialized pointers in this example, L is initialized. And the static translator also hints the location of initialized pointers. So at runtime, all of these hints are coming in. We know allocations locations and sizes. We know locations of pointers. We use all of that information to compute the transitive closure, keep track of the original addresses of pointers so that we can fix them and reload the container later. Right? You can see in this example, our library is completely type unaware. So we do not care whether the pointer or the allocation contains a set of integers or characters or arrays of any sort. It doesn't matter. It's just a chunk of memory. All we care about is whether in that region of memory there are any pointers to other regions of memory. Right? So the only type that we do care about is pointers, right? So that we can compute these closures. And so that simplified our design quite a bit, that we didn't have to worry about type information. And therefore, we are also able to work with a very weakly typed C language, right? Because C language makes it really hard for you to know types statically, and even at runtime, because types can be arbitrarily casted. I can allocate a void star and suddenly say that this void star contains a node of a tree, right, at runtime. So that makes this sort of analysis harder if it were type-aware. So our system is completely type-aware.
What if we have pointers to static pointers element in the stack, not in the heap?
Right. So elements in the stack is right now, the way we deal with it is that we warn the developer that you have a pointer from the heap location to a stack location, and probably you don't want to do that, right? Because what you lose when you restore is your execution context, which means you lose your stack. And if you have a pointer from a container into a stack location, that's going to be a problem. An earlier design that we did was we moved the stack allocation into heap, assuming that the developer had very good reason to create a pointer into a stack region, right? So we have both variants. You know, we either want the developer to say, okay, no, this is not a good idea, and if he insists on it, we move it to the heap so that we can actually restore it.
So
in
that case, you
want to
have an allocate, like how do you identify? Because you have a type assignment from a pointer to...
Right. Okay. So there are some statically allocated data. For instance, if it's a struct, we know the type of the struct at compile time. Right. So if it sits in the stack and we know the type of the allocation. The only thing that can dynamically change are heap allocations. Right? You malloc and then you typecast. Right? So there are some details there, but in general, from a programming philosophy, we believe that it's not a good idea to make persistent data point to stack locations because you lose that context when you restore.
Yes.
So that's sort of the general philosophy we have, and we sort of moved back and forth between doing one way or the other way, and we said, you know, it really doesn't make sense to do it this way. If you want to point to the stack, have some data that you want to make persistent, just put it in the heap. Right?
So with C++, it's going to be much more difficult for you because you're dynamic.
Right. C++ introduces some new challenges, and we've not really thought much about it so far. Is our primary motivation comes from system software and all the optimizations that we were building for Linux. And so we started doing this for C. Okay, so the source-to-source translator, as a recap, records the location size of memory allocations, also records the location of pointers at initialization. And we detect initialization either by explicit initialization, so an L value of an assignment is a pointer type, or implicit initialization where you copy chunks of memory. If there are pointers in the source region, we mark those as pointers in the destination region. Okay. So those are initialized pointers as well. So the high-level architecture is that I'm going to talk about the API in just a bit, but there is a location-independent memory allocator, or LIMA for short, that does a bunch of things, including handling writes at the page granularity and marking pages are either dirty or clean, and a flusher which writes out data in the granularity of chunks that are larger or combinations of pages, multi-page chunks, and then a storage I/O driver that optimizes writing to storage and also makes writes to storage atomic using a transaction model. And we altered our designs a little bit on the storage module for hard disk drives and SSDs, and those are perhaps not the best designs. You guys probably can tell me that that doesn't make sense at all, and I would agree. But whatever we knew about SSDs, we used that information publicly available, and we made some initial implementations. Okay, so here's the API, and maybe I should have come earlier, but here it is. Container allocation, freeing a container, deleting a container. Free means free it from memory, delete means delete it from persistent medium, right? So if you are done using a container, you can also reclaim the space on storage. Ppoint and ppoint sync are the synchronous and asynchronous versions of creating a persistence point. So, and I'll talk very briefly about that. We also have restoring and navigation through branches using restore, switch, and cloning of containers. So actually, I see that I'm, how far along, because we started late.
You have 57 slides. Are all of those?
No. Many of them are backups. I have only 50 slides, actually.
Okay, so you're about 45 minutes in because we started late. So you have about, I would say, another 45 minutes.
Okay.
Maybe another half an hour and then questions.
Okay.
And then we can have some discussion afterwards, so we don't have to keep the focus.
Right. Let me skim over some of the details here because these are fairly standard techniques, and there's not a lot of new things that I can claim here. And jump into results. What I'm illustrating here is a copy and write technique where. And this is a little subtle because the persistence point is already being committed asynchronously, and then the application writes to one of the pages that was marked for checkpointing. We mark it as read-only and create a copy on the fly that gets written out where the original page can be modified by the application without blocking, right? So without blocking for the persistence operation to complete. Right, so those are some of the details, and I'll come back to these details if there's interest. In our evaluation, we looked at three different configurations. The first one we call vanilla, and vanilla is, depending on the application, it either does not have any persistence or it uses our own custom persistence implementation, or it uses its own persistence implementation. So, for instance, something like an SQLite or a Memcached DB, they have their own native persistence implementation. Right? So we use those. This should say TPL. Again, there's a typo. That's a serialization library off the shelf that we use to compare against our system in case there is no native persistence that's implemented. And then, you know, our system itself. It's open source, publicly available. TPL. It's called TPL, not TLP. We wanted to evaluate at least two things. First of all, how development complexity is substantially mitigated, and the other is performance itself. Do we actually get any performance benefits by offloading all the persistence to a library? So first of all, on the development complexity, we looked at lines of code, right? There were a bunch of data structures that we used, and these are the FreeBSD variants of the data structure implementations. We didn't write those in those data structures, right? And then we said, okay, if we use TPL to make those data structures persistent, what's the complexity of the code that we're looking at? This is using a library, by the way,
okay.
Right? And then using our library, right? Extremely simple. There's no magic going on, and that leads to these numbers. You already seen what that involves. With SQLite, it has its own persistence implementation. It's a custom persistence implementation. Very, very complicated because it needs to worry about all kinds of corner cases with respect to atomicity and so on. We actually needed to write only 9 lines of code to achieve similar guarantees as SQLite.
Quick question. Basically, the 3 lines, because you want to create the root pointer, you want to do the first assignment from root to the first head.
Yeah.
And then you have a call to flush.
Exactly.
Why do you need 9 for SQLite?
For SQLite, there were some parts of memory that we had to exclude.
Okay.
So they required some additional inspection of the code.
Okay.
So
exception cases that you write for
right, because our memory closure routine indiscriminately does that transitive closure, and turns out for SQLite there were some parts of the memory space that were pointed to but didn't need to be persistent. So we had to write a whole bunch of excludes. Actually, there were not too many, but we had to write them. Okay, so transaction performance, the dotted line is SQLite native persistence. Ignore the last part. You know, this was very late yesterday night, so ignore the last thing that...
No worries.
Right, so the upper section, so this part you can ignore because it actually refers to the next slide. So the dotted line is the native SQLite persistence, and the solid line is persistence using our library. Right? And for those who don't know much about SQLite, it's a serverless database, so it's a library itself. So it cannot be multiple processes cannot access the database, and it's used primarily for embedded applications like a smartphone, right? So using our library as is provides the same guarantees as SQLite, right? Or the same functionality, let's say.
So these are SQLite transactions that you saw.
Right. Yeah, I switched the graphs at the last minute, sorry. So this graph needs to go into the previous slide, and the graph that was in the previous slide needs to come here. So, but the rest of the descriptions also, doesn't make sense. So in our SQLite workload, just remember that the graph that we had before, the workload actually randomly adds queries and deletes. There's some mix-up here. But let me just tell you about the graphs themselves. Okay. So this graph refers to a Berkeley DB implementation, and it's a key value store, and the workload randomly adds queries and deletes 512 byte elements with 16 byte keys. So Berkeley DB actually has the option to either use a B-tree implementation or a hash table implementation, right? And Memcache D, the persistent version of that, which is called Memcache DB, uses Berkeley DB, right? So what we did was we switched out Berkeley DB and put Sophium library within Memcache D.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that's the result that you're seeing here. Okay. So if you use the B-tree version of Berkeley DB, a hash table version versus Sophium, and the number of transactions per second that you get with each of these cases, there are Berkeley DB has both a synchronous and asynchronous implementation of transactions, right? And we have a synchronous and asynchronous version of Sophium as well. So we could actually compare both versions. In the previous graph, what you see here is just a synchronous against the synchronous version, because SQLite doesn't have an asynchronous implementation. So we did not pit it against our asynchronous implementation. Our asynchronous implementation is off the charts in terms of performance.
Okay.
Right? So this is just a synchronous version.
So the reason why you are getting more transactions is because basically both SQLite and Berkeley DB has large page sizes. Even if you update a small data, you have tried the entire page,
right,
which actually sends you more IOs and more traffic to you. But since you're doing memory level, byte level granularity of tracking changes.
Right. So that's one reason. And even in our system, we do track changes at the page granularity. In fact, it's larger than a page. It's a chunk level granularity, right? And the primary reason we see performance improvement is because we are operating on large chunks, we are able to use this out-of-place writing technique on storage, which guarantees almost sequential writing or writing in granularities of full, say, erase block units inside the flash. So garbage collection operation is optimized. And for disk drives, garbage collection is completely eliminated because you have slots on the disk which are large, and you just need to say which slot is available or not. Right? You don't need to garbage collect data. Data is all within a chunk is always valid. Right? If chunks get invalidated, they get invalidated as a whole. Right? So you have large holes within your disk drive that can be filled out almost semi-sequentially. And that's the I/O optimization that we do for hard disk drives.
But the same thing can be done for Berkeley DB.
You could build a similar optimization for Berkeley DB, mm-hmm. but with Berkeley DB, the layouts are so complicated of the database and the transaction level that it's really hard to achieve a similar translation for those guys. Because, I mean, if we could, one thing which I can think of is to insert another layer at the virtual disk granularity, which does that sort of remapping. But I think the transactions themselves are scattered across multiple chunks. One of the optimizations that allow us to write full chunks is that we separate out volatile and persistent memory, and we group all our persistent memory into these chunk size units. And the other optimization we do is that similar allocation units go into similar chunks. So there is a lot of locality of updates within a chunk. And I'm not sure what kind of update locality something like a Berkeley DB database would have. But it's possible that, with some work, that additional layer of indirection could be added. But it's my belief that Berkeley DB is already optimized for storage. Right? And there is not a whole lot more that you can do in that direction. Maybe there is.
Not for non-volatile storage, for hardware, like basically mainly for disk drives.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just trying to understand what is fundamentally different that you're doing here that gives you such benefits. Is it fundamentally the way you track it, or fundamentally the way you write it, or is it?
I think it's a combination of both. Yeah, it's a combination of both. Because Berkeley DB does write only the dirty information out, so it's already optimized in terms of the amount of data it writes. So my guess is that it's just the way we are able to write to storage that gives us the performance advantages. Okay, so the other thing which I wanted to talk about is scalability. Right? If you have multiple threads in a process, right, or even multiple processes all doing independent checkpoints, the software I/O driver layer is able to interleave all those writes into a sequential pattern on disk. Right? So we scale much better when compared to multi-thread writes that are doing independent checkpoints in different portions of the disk. So that would lead to random writes versus semi-sequential writes in our system. Now the semi-sequentiality here is directly proportional to the amount of extra space you provision for storing your persistent memory, right? And the argument is that storage can be easily over-provisioned relative to the size of DRAM, right? And okay. if you have DRAM of a certain size, you can easily have 10 times as much persistent storage, and then your semi-sequential patterns become almost sequential. Right? So that's one of the arguments here. Okay, to summarize this first part of the talk, we are talking about a very different programming model, memory abstraction for persistent data, fully automated persistence. We have actually transactional persistence, which I haven't talked much about, but it guarantees consistency and durability. It doesn't provide isolation, but it does provide atomicity. So it has three out of the four properties. And isolation, I think, we'll eventually implement as well. High-performance persistent I/O, and right now we are building versioning and out-of-core support. It means that memory that's persistent doesn't need to be in physical memory. It could be on storage somewhere and demand-loaded as necessary, and you still work with exactly the same interface as before. Right? You allocate using something like a malloc, and it would be in physical memory at some point get paced out. Something that's not in physical memory will be paced in dynamically. So we build that sort of support with the out of core implementation.
So does it work with the operating system?
This is all at the library level, all user level. So this assumes that your process has independent access, or let's say a container has independent access to a specific partition on the storage.
Okay.
So that's the assumption. And you could, and that partition is managed by that application. Multiple containers could go into that same partition. Now, if you pull that library out into the OS and build it as a service, then we could provide the same kind of support across all applications using a single partition. And then we would have all the optimizations with the interleaving and sequential writing across all your applications.
Or alternatively, as long as the container model is respected by the operating system,
right.
The operating system or any other application could be using the device for anything else.
Right.
Theory simultaneously.
Right. So one of the early critiques we had for this work was our containers are not readable.
Mm-hmm.
By some random application. So for instance, right now when you store a file, you can open it and look at what's in there and make sense of it, right? Except if you have like a PDF, right? Only a PDF reader can read it. But otherwise, for most ASCII files, any ASCII viewer would be able to make sense of what's there because of the standardization of the ASCII format, right? In our case, what we have on storage is memory. So if you do not know the semantics of those data structures, you cannot make sense of what's on storage. Right? So that was one of the early critiques that we got.
Okay.
Right? So then we said, okay, if you really want to read stuff, then write a reader. Right? And then the reader is a universal reader that gets as input the container semantic information. And then it can read the container.
Even if you annotate the memory, right, you can actually, all you need to do is have a copy of the structures and annotate each memory that you store in the container.
Hmm.
So the reader can actually load up, have the annotation, and have the structures and go through it too.
For instance, yeah, so the container semantics could also be embedded inside. It could be done.
It
yes.
could be like a GDB which has symbol information and just reads out of it.
Right. So that certainly that's yeah. that's possible. So you could make it largely self-contained, and the reader, you know, just like my PDF reader now is able to figure out what's in that PDF file. A container reader would be able to do that. Okay. So the second part of the work is actually two parts, and I really don't know if I have time to go over both these parts. So at this point we have a choice: either pick one. So that I can go into a little bit more detail, or pick both, and I can just do a very brief overview of both of them.
So I think it would be good if you think there's time, you know, to actually do an overview of both, because what that would mean is that we get a kind of a sense of both of them, and then we can always, you know, look at your papers and other things to gather more detail.
Okay.
You know, to learn more, but this will give us a sense of the work.
Sure.
That would be very
the first
helpful.
One is partnership is published. Partially last year, and the second one is unpublished. So, I'll give you a brief overview of both. The first one is actually an OS improvement that we did, which is called non-blocking writes. And what non-blocking writes allows is that applications that write to memory within pages that are not in DRAM do not need to block for pages to be loaded into DRAM. Right, so that's why we call it non-blocking writes. These are non-blocking writes to memory. Right. And so let me dive into that. The problem really arises because the memory access granularity is smaller than the disk access granularity. So whenever you write to memory, to a page that's not in core, it's out of core, because the access granularity to storage is a full page, what the operating system today does is that it loads the entire page and then updates that one byte of memory or a few bytes of memory. And this is true not just for process anonymous memory, where you have store instructions modifying pages, but also for file system page cache memory. So when you write to a portion of a file that's not in physical memory, you have to wait for that portion of the file to be loaded, and then you get to update it. And that blocking is something that has never been explored before. And this is funny because we thought, you know, this is something so fundamental and basic that people should have addressed this problem long time back. So we spent maybe 2 weeks just looking at the literature to see whether people have done this before. And we realized that nobody has looked at this problem before. Because this problem is something that was maybe not even considered important, right? And we were building some completely different system where we ran across this specific problem and we said that we can actually solve this problem. And we pulled this problem out and made that into an independent piece of work. Right. So, to walk you through an example.
I think there's one place.
Yes?
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I think there's one place where folks have been thinking about this, and that's when programming using APIs like MPI,
mm-hmm.
Adding checkpointing services, for example.
Right. Yeah, this is for persistent storage, when you're loading data from persistent storage at the page granularity. So
yeah, and if you're checkpointing over a network, you know, then people are thinking about packets rather than disk sectors.
Okay. Oh, you mean you're talking about the previous work that I was referring to, right? The persistent memory work?
Just in general, I mean, sorry, I was partially listening, so I might be out of context, so I apologize if I am, but I was just thinking about the notion of, you know, aligning the data structures to a sort of a native underlying kind of mechanism, either paging in the memory hierarchy, or in the case of persisting over a network, you know, folks using things like MPI,
mm-hmm.
Those types of libraries to enable their applications are sort of thinking about things from a slightly different point of view. You know, they're thinking about what's the native packet size rather than the disk sector size.
Yeah, so maybe what Robert is referring to is that while this problem has not been looked at in the context of the OS, which is where you're doing it, folks who, for example, had to write things across networks before an HPC kind of environment have had to sort of contend with, you know, sending over IOs or chunks of information that may have no, bear no resemblance to the underlying disk size.
Right.
You're not going to do that, so
right.
Of grouping IOs, gathering them, collecting
yes.
them. Yeah, so.
Right. So in MPI space, there is this thing called MPI I/O,
yes,
right?
Uh-huh,
where they collect a bunch of I/O operations from different MPI processes, and then this aggregator will optimize writing to storage.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So something along those lines. Yes. Yeah. That's true. So there are similar problems in other domains that. Yeah. Very true. And so let me continue here with this example. So let's say a process writes something to memory, to a page, that's not in DRAM, right? That leads to a miss. What the OS does is that it issues a page fetch operation to the packing store. Once that's complete and available in memory, it returns back to the process, right? The process goes ahead and actually succeeds in performing the write, right? So this is the high-level picture that we are looking at. And you can see here, I mean, very curiously, that the process is performing a write. It already has all the data, but it still needs to wait for this dance to happen before it can actually perform the write.
Yeah.
Right? So why wait for data that the application doesn't really need? And that's the question we started off with, right? And this complete operation. And we found that this behavior is preserved across multiple all kinds of system software that we could examine. Linux does it, FreeBSD does it, Zen does it. We have source access to ESX at FIU, and I cannot tell in much detail, but it happens there as well,
for
hypervisor demand paging.
But the write X is basically a memory location. It's not the whole block size granularity that is going to be written back, right? It's because of the interface, basically. All this is
exactly. Well, interestingly, Linux, even if you send a full page aligned, right, it will still fetch the previous version of the page, overwrite it completely. So it's just bad implementation in that case. But those kinds of cases are the only ones that you can handle where your write granularity matches the access granularity.
Yeah.
Then you can avoid the fetch altogether.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. So the basic approach with non-blocking writes is the process performs a write to a page that's not in memory. The OS still handles it because it needs to, as this the process cannot independently complete the write. OS creates a patch, buffers it, issues an IO request to the backing store, and then returns back. So it doesn't wait for the completion. At some later point, the IO will complete, right? And the patch will be merged into the page. Right? So that's sort of the basic idea. So the benefits are the application execution time will reduce because blocking reduces. And the more subtle and really significant improvement here is that the backing store can now see much more IO parallelism.
So would the process have access to the patch when it issues a read before it has been restored?
Right. So if the process tries to read to the same page from a location that it wrote recently, we read from the patch.
Okay.
So even the reads that would otherwise have blocked before now become non-blocking. We call it non-blocking writes because the basic approach is to make writes non-blocking, and as a consequence, the reads also become non-blocking. Yes. Some reads, not all.
No. Yes.
So do you have to issue a TLB shootdown then for the patch so that in shared processor implementations, everybody sees the same thing for a consistent view?
Well, it's inside the OS. So if it's a shared memory page, we are doing this at the frame granularity, all the page table mappings will be invalid throughout as long as this patch exists, as long as the page is not read into memory. So there is no issue of TLB inconsistency because the TLBs are all invalid.
Okay, that's right. Yeah, got it.
Okay. Some motivation, and I don't really think I need to go into much more detail here, but basically we examined that with ESX, memory is highly overcommitted. In fact, the reports we are reading out of VMware is that CPU is highly underutilized, even in virtualized environment with huge multi-tenancy. There is 10% or 20% CPU utilization on an average. Memory utilization on an average is about 40%. So there is this huge gap. Memory, people are willing to push memory overcommitment, but not CPU overcommitment, or maybe the applications are not able to utilize CPU. So that's one of the motivations here, that as you start overcommitting memory, page fetch rates are going to increase, and you have to move towards designs that are more non-blocking. Right?
No, great point.
Thanks. Okay, so the next thing that we did is to examine full system memory access traces. So we collected traces using QMU. So we ran a full OS with multiple applications, and we got full system, very approximately timing accurate memory traces. And we looked at the pages that got referenced and found out if we provision a certain amount of memory using LRU replacement, what pages accesses would result in faults that could be made non-blocking using our approach. Okay. So we did some analysis prior to we actually going and building this out. And we found that the percentage of non-blocking faults for different classes of applications actually vary quite a bit. But in many of the server applications, there's a huge number of faults that can actually be made non-blocking. Okay. And these don't even count the non-blocking reads. When we came up with these numbers, we ignored reads altogether. But the faults, reads are always counted as faults. And this percentage is the total faults. So percentage of non-blocking writes has a fraction of all faults, including write faults and read faults. And the other constraint we added was if there was a read to a page immediately following the write, let's say within a latency of 1 millisecond, we don't count that as non-blocking, right? Because non-blocking doesn't really help, as eventually it will block on a read fault, right? So the blocking advantages of this implementation are not going to be absolute, right? So although we non-block the write, a few subsequent cycles afterwards, there's a blocking read. So we left all of those out. And even after that compensation, we saw these really high numbers, right? So that tells us that there is something that we can get here. The other thing we did, an analysis that we did much later on, is that of the read faults that occurred after making all the writes non-blocking, that we found out that 90% of the reads could be served from patches. From the patches. So even they could you know, benefit from non-blocking. This, as much as, it's not always 90%, but in some cases, it was as much as 90% and even a little bit higher than that.
So on the server side, what was the percentage of read versus write now?
I don't have those individual numbers. I just have some sort of a broad number across one benchmark, which is called DeCapo. It's a set of image processing. So it's a broad number across all of these benchmarks.
So meaning there's no particular percentage group you have for read faults versus write faults?
Oh, okay. Read faults versus write faults. I think I have that number, but not in this presentation.
Okay.
I have it somewhere, but not here.
I don't need to rush you, but could you finish it? So people, if they have questions, we can get to answer them.
Right. So let me tell you some of the challenges that we have here. Right. So processes can either perform writes to memory using a system call, or you know, directly via something like a store instruction. Right? And we built our system for x86. There's a whole complex set of instructions that perform memory writes. So we deal with all of them. The problem is that the first type, which is a system call, is a supervised write. The operating system has all the information to create a patch. But in the unsupervised case, where instructions are writing to memory, some of the information is not readily available. So this is a problem that we addressed. So handling unsupervised writes can be done in multiple ways. One is that you have the hardware give all the information to create a patch, and all the information here is this set of three pieces of information: is the new data or location of memory where the new data is, the number of bytes that got written, and the address it got written to. Right? Those are the three pieces of information we need to create a patch. We can have the hardware inform us about all these three pieces of information. But the problem is that it can be really fast, and the amount of memory overhead that it uses would be insignificant, but the architectures don't support it. Sorry about that. We could do single stepping.
What do you mean from the architecture?
So architectures...
What do you propose an increment?
Right, so with the architecture, besides just the faulting address,
okay,
we would also need what is the size of the data that got written to that address.
Oh, I see. Okay. All
right. Right.
Okay.
That becomes very complicated with x86, for instance.
Yeah, I can see how.
Because there are multi-word writes going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But even when you're still looking at the file system page sizes, right, these buffers that you look at are basically the real pages that exist in the operating system.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you have to worry about the store instruction?
Because the store instruction could be writing to virtual memory.
Yeah. Only when the virtual memory gets translated, it comes with the page size.
Right, but to create a patch so that we don't block on the demand paging, we need the patch to make the application continue even after a virtual memory page fault. So without blocking on the demand paging, right? So that's why we also address this unsupervised faults, which are writes to virtual memory. We implemented a single stepping solution where we allocate an additional page, write into that page and extract the patch from there, right? So the problem with single stepping is that it's really slow, and this one of the reasons why this is slow is because we need to switch to user space, invalidate TLBs, switch to user space, execute the instruction, invalidate TLB again, extract the patch, and then continue, right? So there's substantial slowdown with single stepping. There's another alternative that we thought about, which is the page diff merge. Write to two pages, one full of zeros, other full of ones, and then do an XOR to extract the patch. Right, so that's another possibility. But the final solution that we did go ahead and implement is opcode disassemblies, to just disassemble the opcode to extract the patch directly from accessing physical memory. And that turned out to provide good speed, very good speed, and it requires work, but it can be done for every architecture you can think of, and there is very little memory overhead. Whereas the single stepping and the page diff merge need that additional page that you would extract from. So let me just go to this last slide, and there's a gap, but in the interest of time, let me go here. We estimated how much execution time could be impacted if we had non-blocking writes for these workloads, and this is all simulation with having full system memory access traces. We assumed that extracting the patch would have zero overhead, and in our measurements with the opcode disassembly, it really turns out to be negligible. Right? So that's a reasonable assumption. So you can see that the execution time improvements are varied, and we assume that applications block on I/O 35% of the time, based on some other study someone did, and that may or may not be true. Applications may be blocking 90% for I/O, and if that's true, these numbers will actually look better. It all depends on where the bottleneck is in the system. The bottleneck is not I/O, none of this helps. If you're already 100% CPU utilized, none of this helps, right? So with some assumptions, this is what we can expect. So all of this is simulation. Right now, we actually have a system that works. We are running experiments, and hopefully I'll have some real numbers to report soon. Let me talk about the next piece of work on partitioning SSD caches. And the first point I'll make here is that and the problem setting, very briefly, is that hypervisor is managing host-side SSD caches, something like a Fusion I/O card or a set of them. It turns out that when there are multiple VMs running, and you use, let's say, a caching policy in the hypervisor that manages the cache as a unified whole across all the VMs, then there is this very peculiar problem that shows up, right, which we call wastage. So if we take individual MRCs across workloads, say VMs A and B, we see the graph on the top, and ideally, your working set is where the knee breaks, right? And you add up those working set estimates, you are off by quite a bit in the combined MRC. And that's because of contention, right? So this discrepancy right here between this line and this line, in this case, turns out to be about 10%, right? What we found is, so unified caches induce wastage due to contention, right? And this wastage actually increases linearly as a percentage as you increase the number of workloads, simultaneously running workloads. So if you look at this graph, wastage of the cache space increases linearly as a percentage. Okay? So it's not an absolute number of wastage. The relative wastage, if you keep adding more and more tenants on top of your hypervisor, the percentage wastage is going to blow up. Right? So that's a real problem. You need to address this contention. And why does it grow up linearly? Is because as you add one more workload, that workload is contending with not one, but everyone else that was running before it. Right? So it's sort of a compounding effect, if you will. In terms of wastage due to contention, right? So this is something that we found, and then we realized, yes, it should be like this, right? Earlier we thought, okay, wastage would be some constant, but it turns out not to be the case, right? So it's a really important problem to solve. So what we did was we built a partitioned caching solution for ESX, right? Multiple VMs that are managing multiple virtual disks. These virtual disks now span not just a file system in a storage network, but also a portion of the file system would be on the SSD. That's basically the cache, right? There are two entities that we built inside the hypervisor, a global scheduler and a data mower. Global scheduler resizes the partitions online, right? by observing the workload and how the MRCs change, and the data mover actually moves data between the cache and the storage periodically.
Oh, okay.
Right, so those are the two pieces that we built in ESX. Now, it turns out that even partitioning is not all that easy, right? And that's because people have looked at partitioning approaches in the past for CPU caches. And CPU caches are partitioned. For instance, the instruction and data cache, they are partitioned on the CPU. There is no contention there. Right? And people have also looked at partitioning CPU caches across workloads. And a very common approach is this convex hull-based identification of the partition sizes. So if you have two MRCs, let's say this gray MRC and this, sorry, the red MRC and the blue MRC, the blue MRC, the colors don't show up on the screen, but I'm
I hope they show up pretty reasonably on the WebEx.
So. Okay, that's good. So the red MRC is actually just flipped around and makes it easier to visualize the sum of these two MRCs, right? And the gray bar on top is the sum of these two MRCs. You see, the sum of the MRCs to take a minimum point is not straightforward, because what you really need is a partition where the sum of the MRCs is minimum, right? So what people do, the standard technique is to apply a convex hull on this combination of MRCs, and could be multiple, as many as you can, just add them all together, take a convex hull, which is very smooth, and you can walk down this convex hull using classic hill climbing and find the minimum point, and that's your partition.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what has been around in the literature. And we tried to use this. And we found out that there was a serious problem. Okay. And the problem is the following. Because now your SSD cache is an external cache, and the request sizes to the cache can be arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
Right? As a VM, you cannot tell the VM that, you know, access the cache only at this granularity. It may issue any I/O. One of the primary assumptions of this convex hull approach is that the MRCs themselves are relatively convex, and the sum of the MRCs are approximately convex. And then you can apply a convex hull approach. It turns out that with SSD caches, it is very easy to get concave MRCs. So if you look at that chart up there, with a request size of one page, if all request sizes are one page, as you increase the size of the cache, your miss rate starts going down linearly. And this is assuming a perfect replacement algorithm. On the other hand, if your request size is 64 pages, then the MRC becomes concave. And is it as concave as the size increases. It becomes more and more concave. So if you take a convex hull approach and compute this, what they call as a convex minorant of the hull, then you can have substantial error in your prediction of miss rates. So for instance, at 500,000 cache size, if you use a convex hull approach and your block size are 64 pages, exercise 64 pages, then you can have 60% error in the miss rate estimates. Okay. So we realized that you cannot use conventional convex hull-based hill climbing approaches to find the partition sizes for external caches. So once we know this problem, the solution is somewhat obvious. Right? Use full MRCs. And use more probabilistic techniques like simulated annealing to find the best point in the sum of the MRC curves and partition according to that. The challenge is, well, how do you compute the MRCs quickly and how do you quickly find out the minimum of the sum of the MRCs, right? So that you can have a timely partitioning recommendation and that you can implement quickly to react to workload changes. So we built a system and that does some of this, and I'm going to just show you some results again. It's a bootstorm case study where you have multiple VMs simultaneously booting. In this case, there were 28 virtual desktops. And what I'm showing here is our partitioned cache implementation which uses LFU. Actually, it's an aged LFU replacement versus a unified cache at the hypervisor level that also uses aged LFU. And so the couple of observations here is that, first of all, there's 20% reduction in overall boot times. Right? So that's a big improvement. And the more interesting improvement, which is also important, is that the variance in the boot times also reduces significantly. So if you see that the boxes are much more flatter than the circles, right? That means the variance is lower. And the reason why that happens is because a unified cache replacement algorithm can be unfair. It can give you a lot more cache to one VM, a lot less cache to the other, depending on how VMs issue IO requests. Okay, so based on the load, it may estimate the requirements incorrectly at a given point in time. So that increases the variance as well. We also replayed a bunch of production storage traces.
Yeah, we are.
Okay, so this is the last one.
Yep.
Okay.
And we actually I incorrectly cut and paste the previous graph, so I don't really have data to show you, but I can show you offline. I do have the graph. But yeah, but the idea here again is 20% reduction in response times, and this also has direct implications for storage. Actually, 20% reduction in cache misses. That means 20% less IOs going over the network to the storage, right? And also reduced IO latency. So let me just acknowledge the team here. It's just not me. In fact, most of this work is done by others. And so these are the students. Actually, I'd like to point out that Leonardo is going to be interning with you guys for the summer.
Yeah, I believe he's arriving May 7th.
So he's been doing some work on SSD caches recently, and
he
did a lot of the work on the software persistent memory.
Yeah.
All the static translation was done completely by him.
Thank you very much, Leonardo. This was a great talk. But please, the folks on the phone have any questions.
Sure.
We had about somewhere between 20 and 25 people calling in.
Great.
Folks, do you have any other questions?
Well, thanks for attending. I'm really looking for.
I've got one. I mean, real quick. I'm sorry. I know you're trying to wrap up here. This last section of the talk seemed like rocket science, quite frankly, and I wonder whether you kind of balance that with the effort to annotate your program to be more explicit about it, what's going on.
No, I think a lot of, except for the software persistent memory project, most of our projects have been looking at applications as a black box, even virtual machines as black boxes, and assuming no information flows across the guest hypervisor boundary. And that makes things a lot more challenging in my opinion. But given that, standards are really hard to break and change, it's a safe assumption as far as we are concerned.
And from the point of view of research, it's a good assumption that's actually a harder problem.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
So one of the...
Not necessarily the assumption we might make.
Right. I mean, you guys are at the forefront, and you may have more visibility into what can actually change or what is more pliable. We don't have that sort of insight or view. So that's been one of the philosophies for us, and which is why we decided to call our system software persistent memory and build a completely software solution that works with commodity OSs and commodity devices. If I were in industry, I would probably be thinking differently, but since I'm not, there are some constraints that I would rather follow and have my research to be more useful than to make assumptions that may or may not pan out.
So I think to kind of a first order, I would think that the things that you develop would be perhaps enhanced by any form of annotation or other information exchange. that might occur. Would you agree with that, or would some of it be replaced, do you think?
I think at a high level, I can see that as being largely complementary. Okay. So if there are optimizations that assume systems to be black box and just observe what's going on to make changes, if there is additional information, I can see how it would be complementary. Whether it invalidates some of the things that we have been doing, it's not clear. It depends on the kind of information.
Okay.
For instance, with the partitioning approach, there was one alternative that people have been talking about, which is to have guests manage the SSDs directly, right? Because the guests know their workload better, right? And they can possibly just have a very simple API with the hypervisor that asks for more reservation, increases reservations, decreases reservations to a shared SSD cache. So I think that's certainly possible with plugins inside the guest. So that's another philosophy of our work is to implement things where it would be easiest to be incorporated.
Right.
And I feel like especially the partitioning work is easiest incorporated inside the hypervisor.
It's an interesting question. I think I'm going to take that to mean that we're about to get kicked out of the room.
Yeah.
But I think one question I would ask is, so there's sort of this, so the industry, you know, including us, have moved into advocating and sometimes implementing certain kind of declarative approaches, right?
Right.
Where, you know, people, information is exchanged very explicitly. So, for example, in C10, you know, in the SCSI committee, there is an effort underway to try to propose and standardize hints, you know, and things like that. And I think there's a couple of questions that sort of more at a more high level kind of come up for me. One of them is that, you know, in some ways applications always know their own workload better than, you know, a shared layer. However, a shared layer always sees more.
That's true.
Right? And
that's
there's
true.
Some balance between those two things that
yes.
is a very interesting problem in its own right.
Absolutely.
And you know, in some ways the Nirvana solution is that information somehow passed along, and so that the entity that sees all also knows all.
Right.
But that requires a level
standardization
of standardization that we don't have today.
Right.
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 Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I absolutely agree.
Is very, you know.
Yeah. The balance of knowledge, detailed individual knowledge versus global coarse grained knowledge. I think that's a fine balance to
yeah.
that needs to be struck.
And that's an interesting question.
Yeah, so we've so far pushed towards, you know, global imperfect knowledge because, you know, a single solution can address multiple workloads and may also be easy to incorporate into existing systems. And that's why we've taken the approach that we took in that third project. But I do agree that with more visibility into what the guest is doing, you know, we could do better. For instance, the guest could hint saying that, well, now I'm going to a phase of my workload where I need a lot less cache, right? And so you can take cache away from me and so on.
That's an interesting problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, folks on the call, thank you very much for attending. I think we're about to get kicked out of the
yeah.
room, and so...
Let's thank the speaker.
Yeah,
thank you
that.
Very much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me here.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks.